Okay.
All right. So way back in the day before Pesach, when we finished Parak Yud Daled, we saw that after the whole battle that that Shmuel fought against the Shaul fought against the Plishtim, the Navi took a giant step back and it told us about Shaul's whole reign in general. And it described how Shaul, in an unbelievable show of will, knits the country together, creates a standing army, and fights off the armies all around Klal Yisrael, in the north, in the south, the east, the west. One of the armies that the Pasuk said he fought off was the army of Amalek, who apparently had been regularly raiding and invading the south of Israel. And he achieves a level of stability, which Bnei Yisrael had so desperately needed. Now, at the time we saw, remember, that the way Shaul does this is not ideal. You know, you'd want to have a king who is inspiring people to follow him. The model that Shaul comes into is more a model of forcing the people to follow him. And that has drawbacks, because at the end of the day, when it's the end of the battle and they're exhausted and you're trying to get them to go on one more level, Shaul finds that there's only so far he can go. There's no question he's achieved a lot from where they were basically occupied by the Plishtim. So Perek Tezvav then begins, now that Shaul has achieved stability, or the borders of the country have been established, we have an independent state, we're no longer subordinate to the Plishtim, there's an army, there's some basic level of peace, including Amalek has been fought off. So now Shmuel comes to Shaul and gives him the famous commandment to shift from defense to offense. And the target that Shaul has to go on offense against is Amalek, which we talked about last week, the idea that Amalek poses a unique ideological problem for Malchus, because the Jewish kingship that we're trying to set up is one where we're threading this needle, where on the one hand, we now have a king of flesh and blood, but on the other hand, that king of flesh and blood has to constantly realize that he has not replaced Ribono Shel Olam, and that Hashem is still the one ultimately in charge operating through Hashkacha. Amalek, who denies any divinity, any higher power, any morals, so they stand as a total antithetical reality. And that's what Shaul has to go to fight against. So load up the screen shares 1 second. And here we go. We'll probably do like the first half of the parak this week, go through the battle, and then we'll cover the fallout of the battle next week. You know, before we even start, one thing to keep in mind as we learn the parak is that normally we think of Shaul and Amalek, and it's such a classic story, but we think of it in those terms, just of Shaul and Amalek. But as we'll see, there are really two protagonists in the whole story, because it's not just Shaul, it's also Shmuel. Shmuel is very, very much a leading character in Parak Tesvav. And we're really exposed to the two models of leadership. And we'll see that as Shaul fails, that's going to bring out the success of Shmuel. We should just keep in mind the Navi really is going to be looking at these two leaders in parallel. Okay. So the first pasuk, and it's one we have to unpack because it's just going to be, it's worded in a funny way. Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul. So Shmuel says to Shaul, Osi shalach Hashem limshachacha lemelach alamo al Yisrael. I am the one who Hashem sent to anoint you as a king over his nation, over Israel. Ve'ata shema lekol divrei Hashem. Now listen to the voice of the words of Hashem. So first thing that might jump out is that is a very, very funny way of speaking. Listen to the voice of the words of Hashem. That is redundant. You could say, Shema l'Hashem, Shema l'Kol Hashem, Shema l'Dvar Hashem, Shema l'Kol Divrei Hashem, listen to the words of the voice of the words of Hashem is redundant. So you wonder, why is it that Shmuel begins his pep talk that way, his speech that way? Now, we'll notice, scroll down a little bit, the being the words which are used over and over again in this parak, which is already, the tone is being set from the very beginning, the idea of listening and the voice and the word, shmia and kol and devar, come up again and again in this parak. As we all go through in detail, and we'll see it one by one, but just to sketch it out now, you can see the yellow, blue, and purple highlights, that the idea of listening, devar Hashem, devar Hashem, devar Hashem, devar Hashem, kol Hashem, kol Hashem, kol Hashem, it is pervasive in this parak. Reason why, just giving the game away at the beginning, is that is going to be the whole issue, right, for Shaul and Amalek, is setting aside his ethical challenges, setting aside his personal advantages of this war, and doing this exclusively for the as a reaction to listening to what Hashem says. That is going to be the test, and that is going to be the failure that Shaul has in this whole parak. And Shmuel lays it out at the beginning. The whole mission for you is listen to the voice of the words of Hashem. He beats it over and over again because that is the whole challenge over here. And that's going to be the running theme throughout the parak. Okay. Now, we also might note that, isn't it a little bit funny how Shmuel begins his talk, right? Like, I am the one who Hashem sent. It's like, you know, was he lording it over Shaul over here? It seems like what Shmuel is doing is he's trying to remind Shaul that you are the king, yes, but ultimately, you know, you're only the king because I anointed you and because Hashem chose you. You owe everything you have to God. Nothing of it is of your own accord. Shmuel realizes that what he's about to ask Shaul to do is hard. And he is trying to reinforce, in Pasuk Aleph, right? He realizes this is not an easy mission he's giving Shaul. He's going to need to draw on reserves of Emuna. He's going to have humility, put himself in his place, realize that Hashem is above him. Without Yerushalayim, this whole project is not going to work. And so Shmuel is trying at the very beginning, right? Both from emphasizing, remember, I'm the Navi and Hashem anointed you, and driving home, listen to the words of God, the Yerushalayim that is going to be needed for the following mission. Yeah. Okay. We also might consider one other piece. If we remember way back in Parak Tes, when Shaul first met Shmuel, we pointed out there that the theme of that parak, the word that was being used over and over again, was seeing. Remember, that's where Shaul and his lad are looking for the seer, right? Where's the ro'eh? And seeing was coming up again and again and again. And what that was telegraphing was thinking of Shaul and the importance of appearances. This was a guy who we were introduced to, and he's 6'5", and he's handsome, and he looks like a leader. And the real question was, what do things look like versus what are they in reality? And the way the Navi undercut that whole parak was after having those 7 or 8 cases of seeing, the Navi said, you know, Hashem then comes to Shmuel, and the Navi used that very, very strange term for what the Nevuah was. It said Hashem revealed the ear of Shmuel. Hashem gila es ozen Shmuel. That really, the whole point of Nevuah, it's all about listening. Setting aside the seer and the appearances, the real question is, can you listen? Remember, Shaul thought of the prophet as a seer as opposed to a Navi, a speaker. The real challenge, the real job of a Navi is not to show you where your donkeys are and have visions and have access to information. In fact, as we'll see, there are times in this parak where Shmuel seems to lack information. The real purpose of the Navi is to speak, to communicate what Hashem wants. Your job is to listen. It is Shmia, not Ri'iyah. And that's being laid out here. Shmia coming up again and again. The parak. Can Shaul, the man of appearances, can he shift from the world of seeing to the world of hearing? Spoiler alert, the answer is going to be no. But let's proceed and look more now in some detail. Rashi has one very interesting comment on that word, which we should look at. Shema l'kol divrei Hashem. Look what Rashi says. Why is he saying this? Tamachas niskalta, ata hizaher b'yatzmacha. So Rashi writes, why is Shmuel, and this is the reason, why is Shmuel talking about the importance of listening to the voice of Hashem? You failed once, now be careful. So let's think about that for a second. Where has Shaul failed? So the way Rashi's doing here is he's saying, Shmuel, I thought Shmuel told Shaul he wasn't going to be king two prakim ago, right? Shaul did not wait for Shmuel to start bringing the karbanos. Shmuel said to him, look, if you behave this way, you're going to lose the kingship. So now apparently Shaul is still king. So Rashi says, yeah. That's why we begin the parak over here with Shmuel giving Shaul a pep talk. You have a second chance. You messed up once. You have a second chance. That means that something else that Rashi is putting into our brains as we begin the story is Rashi is putting tshuva in here at the beginning. Right? Rashi is saying, Shaul is being given a second chance. Hashem gives second chances. The tragedy of that is that so much of Shaul's failure in this story, which we'll explore more next week, is going to be his failure to do tshuva. Rashi is putting it at the beginning of the story. You're getting a second chance. Afal pichin, Shaul is not going to do tshuva when given the opportunity on a silver platter later on in the parak. So we're driving home the importance of Yerushalayim. We're seeing the challenge that Shaul is going to have, the importance of listening to the voice of Hashem. Now, we'll see what the mission is. So, but another continuous pasuk is, Ko amar Hashem tzivakos, bakarati yisasher asam aleik yisrael, asher sam lo baderach balosim yimitzrayim. I remember what Amalek did hundreds of years ago when they ambushed us coming out of Egypt. Ata leich biyikis asam aleik, bacharamtem esko asher lo. Lo sachmo lalav, do not have mercy. The himata ish aisha meolel vad yonek mishor vad sam yigamal vad chamor. Shmuel does not pull any punches. You have to wipe them all. You have to wipe them all out. Now, the commandment here in this pasuk of number one, not having any mercy, and also detailing every one and everything that has to be destroyed, people and animals. Shmuel is very, he's evoking two mitzvos that we have in Sefer Devarim, which we should unpack what the association is. They're back to back. They're in Parshas Re'eh. There's one other time in Tanakh where we're told, Lo Sachmol. Normally, descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were told to have mercy. Twice in Tanakh we're told not to have mercy, Lo Sachmol. Once, Shaul right here with Amalek. The other time, here in Re'eh, when we face the Mesis. Torah says, when you have someone who is trying to get you, to seduce you into worshiping Avodah Zarah, so you have to react strongly, Lo Sachos Inacha, the Lo Sachmol. So one other time you're told don't have mercy is when you have someone who is enticing you to Avodah Zarah. Immediately afterwards, after the Torah Re'eh talks about the Mesis, who does it talk about? The Yarni Dachas, the city which has all fallen into idolatrous worship. And there we have the obligation to wipe out the entire city and its animal. You burn everything, you destroy everything, it can never be rebuilt. That city and its memory have to be destroyed. So when Shmuel is telling Shaul to go fight Amalek, to go destroy Amalek, he's telling him he has to bring in the attitude towards fighting the Mesis and fighting the Irani Dachas. This is a war against Avodah Zarah. And we understand from last week what that means, because quite ultimately Avodah Zarah is not just about bowing down to Zeus. Avodah Zarah really is about denying the authority of God. And that we saw last week was what Amalek stood for on the most elemental level. They don't even recognize any divinity or higher power. So Shmuel is framing the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek using the frame of destroying Avodah Zarah. The Mesis, the individual who is enticing you, bringing you in, which is interesting because that raises the suggestion, would it be possible for, you know, if we leave Amalek alone, for us to fall into their ways? And then number two, the Irani Dachas, the city, the civilization, which has fallen into Avodah Zarah. That's the frame that's being used for Amalek, thinking of them in terms of Avodah Zarah. Now, Shaul should be very sensitive to this, because Shaul Chazal point out, was outstanding in his opposition to Avodah Zarah. There are, at the end of Shmuel Aleph, we're going to see, he couldn't find a witch or a magician in Eretz Yisrael. Shaul, along with his single-minded devotion to uniting the country, is absolutely devoted to wiping out idolatry. Or so he thinks. Because, as we'll see, starting maybe this week and then unpacking it more next week, really, both as we go through this, something to see is thinking about Avodah Zarah from a more sophisticated perspective. That even though Shaul is all in on wiping out the witches and wiping out the idols and the statues, the idea behind Avodah Zarah, which is about worshiping something other than God, is going to be an area where Shaul is going to fail. He's going to fail because he's not going to listen to the voice of Hashem. He's going to listen to a different voice, the voice of himself. It's going to be self-worship. That's what Shmuel is saying. Shmuel is saying this is a war against Avodah Zarah. Now, there's one other piece to note in Shmuel's original prophecy. And by the way, we have Shmuel, another innovation from Shmuel. Right? Shmuel, who he founded the monarchy. Now Shmuel is founding a new institution, which is the Navi who talks to and instructs the Melech. The rest of Sefer Shmuel, Sefer Melachim, this is going to be standard. The Navi, Atachnum came back today, right? So we had David talking to God, right? We were back to the world of kings and prophets. This is the first time Shmuel is now setting up that institution. The Melech comes to the Navi comes to the Melech, bringing the command of Hashem. Okay, now where was it? Yeah. So interesting. Shmuel begins his talk by saying, Koamar Hashem Tzivakos. Not Koamar Hashem, but Koamar Hashem Tzivakos. And Sefer Shmuel, that's a loaded term. Because remember, Chazal pointed this out at the very beginning of the Sefer. Who was the first person to call Hashem, Hashem Tzivakos? That's Chana, right? Right? Shmuel is using his mother's term for God. He's using his mother's term for God. And Chana, that was all about recognizing the total total supremacy of Hashem. Hashem Tzivakos, Hashem master of hosts. Recognizing total dominant supremacy, Hashem's power and authority is unlimited. We may see a world of kings, we know behind that is Hashem Tzivakos. We may see a world where one woman is having many children and one woman can't have any, we know behind that is Hashem Tzivakos. Hashem can turn around in an instant. That was Shirat Chana, and that was the defining Hashkafic question, which sets up all of Sefer Shmuel. On what side of this do you belong? Are you on the side of Chana that recognizes this? Are you on the side of Eli and his children who did not? So, and we're going to see several points in the Parak of Amalek where the legacy of Chana is going to be invoked. It'll come a little bit stronger later on, but already we have it here, and we have it here twice. Number one, the first thing Shmuel says, Hashem Tzivakos, using his mother's term. Number two, Pakadati. Hashem says, I remember what Amalek did to Yisrael. Last time we saw Hashem remembering something, last time we had Hashem Pakad in Sefer Shmuel was Hashem Pakad as Chana. We had Hashem remembering Chana and then having her conceive Shmuel. Now we have Hashem remembering again. So the Pikida, Hashem's memory, Hashem's power, Malchios and Zechronos from Rosh Hashanah, when we read Shirat Chana, Shmuel is bringing that in here. We need a world of Yerushalayim. We need to recognize that you may be the king, Shaul. You may be the king, but I am the prophet who is above you, and I'm the one who is telling you what you have to do. Set aside what you want. Set aside what you think. Go. Don't have mercy. Of course, the fact that Shmuel tells Shaul don't have mercy implies that the natural human reaction Shaul would have, like any normal person, would be to react against this commandment to wipe out man, woman, and child. Otherwise, he would need to say, lo tachmol alav, that merciful reaction is expected. Shmuel is saying, set aside what you think, just go do it, listen to the Kol Hashem. Okay, so now it's, here we go. What is Shaul's reaction, right? Look at this, Pasuk Daled. that Shaul has to gather an army. So what word does the Torah, does the Navi use to say this? Vaishama Shaul Asa'am. How do they translate? Shaul summoned the people. But come on, why is that the word choice that the Navi uses? We know how Shaul gathers the people. This happened a few prakim ago when Shaul gathered the army to fight Ammon. It said a language of za'aka, crying out. That's a much more expected term. You send out you send out a cry. You make an announcement. Why is the Navi specifically saying vaishama? He made it heard to the people. So another example of the Navi using introducing the concept of hearing shmiya. This is going to be a repeated theme, even in cases here when it's not needed. It's because the Navi wants that idea to be in our head. Okay. Shaul gathers the army together. Last time we did this against Ammon, it was a brilliant success. He does this again. He counts the people with sheep, whether it's his own sheep. The Gemara suggests that Shaul was so wealthy at this time, he could use his own sheep to count the people. Of course, we know you can't count people directly. Whether it's the people's sheep, whatever exactly is going on. I think Dan Bikram quoted a view that it was actually, they used their carbon Pesach. Gemara Pesachim says that at times they used people's carbon Pesach as a way of doing a census. So you count like a kidney from the sheep. Either way, 200,000 people, that's pretty good. 10,000 people from Yehuda. Now, let's think about that for one second, because we know some of the political tension that is operating in the background of Shaul's reign, and it's going to come out much more strongly once David gets in the picture, and we'll meet him next parak, which is Yehuda is the biggest of the tribes. They're in the south, and to some degree, they're separate from the rest of Klal Yisrael. They've been the Shevet most threatened by the Plishtim. In the Shimshon stories in Shoftim, Yehuda is totally dominated by the Plishtim because they're in the south. They're the ones who are most exposed. So they're the biggest. They've had the most national security problems. They're subsuming themselves under Shaul from the little tribe next door of Binyamin. Right? There's no brother who likes to, no big brother likes to listen to the little brother. When the little tribe right next door is the Melech, that's not easy. So Shaul ruling over Yehuda is a problem, especially because we know Yehuda really is a tribe that's supposed to rule, right? People in Yehuda, they know Sefer Bereishis. They can read the bracha in Vayechi. They can read the brachos in Vezos HaBracha. They know that Yaakov Avinu gives the kingship to Yehuda. We're a lion. You're a wolf. Why does the wolf rule over the lion? So you can imagine that there's a lot of delicacy in the relationship right here. Now, at the same time, Yehuda is the Shevet, which presumably is having the most difficulty with Amalek, because Yehuda lives in the south, and Amalek, who sends out raiders to attack all the neighboring settlements. So they're not running all the way into the Galil. You don't get desert raiders going all the way up into the north. They go to the local tribe, so they go to Yehuda. So Yehuda is presumably facing the brunt of the attacks of Amalek. So there's a real opportunity here for Shaul, because if Shaul can protect Yehuda from Amalek, that can be a real boon to his position as king. Something to think about when we think about Shaul's own motivations, maybe, in fighting this war. So he has the army together. He has people from Yehuda. They're happy to go to war too. This is a war that's going to be very beneficial for Yehuda. Pasuk Hey, very odd pasuk. We'll see what Chazal say about it in a minute. Famous comment that they have. And then we'll read Pasuk Hey, Pasuk Vav, we'll go back. So Shaul approaches the city of Amalek. Before I shouldn't talk about what this means exactly. They don't seem to have had real cities. They were a bunch of desert raiders. He's approaching the main encampment of Amalek. Vayarev banachal. Normally it means he fought. Right? A riv is a fight. So he fought in the valley. What's the problem with translating this as fighting, though, is Pasuk Vav, the next Pasuk, it's clear that the hostilities haven't started yet, because Shaul turns to the Keni, that's the tribe of Yisro, who, from the time of Yisro himself, lives right next door to Amalek. Back in Sefer Shmos, Amalek attacks, and then immediately Yisro hears. And the Farshim say, what did Yisro hear? He heard about the war against Amalek. He's right next door. When Bilam gives his prophecies, he mentions the Cainy and Amalek living right next to each other. So Shaul says to the tribe of the Cainy, get out of here, because I don't want you to be collateral damage. You guys helped Bnei Yisrael. Yisro was helpful to the Jews in the Midbar. I don't want any innocent victims, right? I have to fight. I have to kill civilians, but I don't want to kill any innocent victims. So he sends the Cainy away. Now, it's clear then that the war hasn't started yet, because you don't start fighting and then tell the people who you want to kill to leave. So it's clear that he hasn't started yet fighting. So the question is, what exactly does it mean by Yarev Banachal? It doesn't mean that he's fought yet. These big translate over here, they lay in wait, like he set an ambush. But that doesn't make any sense. Shaul doesn't ambush Amalek. He goes in guns blazing. 210,000 soldiers. He just marches right in there. He's gonna smack him. So what does it mean? So Rashi quotes the Gemara, Yuma Chaf Beis Mabez. We saw parts of this Gemara earlier, where the Gemara had the idea that the problem with Shaul, remember, the problem with Shaul is that he was too perfect. Gemara said, we don't want a leader who doesn't have skeletons in his closet, or literally a box of rodents hanging around his neck. Because in order to be a leader, you have to realize, you have to appreciate human weakness. And the fact that Shaul was the Prince Charming from Central Casting with no defects, modesty, everything, he wasn't set up to appreciate and understand failure, which is going to hurt him in the long run. Gemara here has another core insight. What does it mean, Vayarev? So let's read the Rashi and then think about it for a second. Vayilachem Benachal. So first Rashi says, no, I'll tell you the Pshuto Shel Mikra, it means he fought. One pasuk later, he's not fighting yet. Okay, introducing it, right? He fought in the valley. Ain mukta mukha Torah. Things are not always in perfect chronological order. Before he fought, he told the kingdom to leave. Okay, fine. But continues Rashi. But saying to Abu, you know the Agata. Al iske nachal rav bedan as atzmo. He debated. A riv can be a debate. He debated on the matters of the river and judged for himself. What's going on here? Continues Rashi. Ma bishvil nefesh achas amra Torah arof egla benachal. Torah said you have one soul and you chop the calf at the river. This is the mitzvah of egla arufa. If we have an unknown, if we have a murder victim, we don't know the perpetrator. So we take the calf to the nachal, right? Here Shaul is at the nachal. He's at the river stream in the wilderness. You take the calf there. So says Shaul, if we do the whole Egla Arufa ritual, we bring judges from the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim to go to Yehapitzvil Nachal to do an Egla Arufa. We take one life so seriously. Bishvil kol hanafashos ha'elu lo kol shekein. Intended to wipe out an entire nation. Im adam chata, behema machata. The people sinned. What was the sin of the animals? So Rashi has the Gemara here, putting in Shaul's thought. We'll unpack it a little bit in a second. Just what are we saying? Shaul pauses, right? Don't read this as Shaul fights. Read this as Shaul pauses right before he goes to fight Amalek, and he debates with himself. He says, how can I massacre civilians? That does explain the next pasuk, where he says, you know, okay, I'll start. In a good way, we're happy with Pasuk Vav, by clearing out the Cainy civilians. But the Chazal here have Shaul weighing the ethical challenge of the mitzvah. I did not put this on the source. It's totally fine. But something to understand, where, like, Egal, as the Gemara would say, Egla Rufa Mandakar Shmei. Who mentioned Egla Rufa? Okay, Nachal, so you have a riverbed. But other than that, where is Egla Arufa coming from? So, if you think about where Egla Arufa shows up in the Chumash, it's very interesting where the Torah puts it. It's at the very, very end of Parshas Shoftim. We know the beginning of the next Parsha is Ki Seitzei La Milchama. The Torah is in the middle talking about the laws of war. But Egla Rufa is actually dropped smack in the middle of a bunch of halachos of the ethics of warfare. The Torah at the end of Sefer Shoftim tells us the mitzvos of offering peace to our enemies before we attack them, which very importantly, by the way, we should know, the Rambam Paskins is true for Amalek as well. But even before attacking Canaan or Amalek, the Rambam rules, you first have to offer them peace terms. And if they don't agree to live with basic ethics and Shiva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, only then do you go and fight them. So the Torah says you have to offer peace. And the Torah there talks about setting up the Kohen Mashuach Melchama and thinking about who fights in your army. If someone is just getting married, they don't belong in the army. If someone is just getting started out in life with a vineyard or a house, they shouldn't fight. Torah then talks about when you besiege an enemy city, so don't let destruction get the best of you. Keep the fruit trees up. You have all these laws of warfare. Then you have Yafas Tawar, where the Torah is struggling, right, what to do exactly with the, you know, human nature in combat. Smack in the middle of the laws of warfare, we have something that doesn't belong at all, which is Egla Arufa. Why is it there? Why do we go from Melchama to Egla Arufa and then back to Kitei Tzela Melchama Alay Vecha? And what the Torah clearly is getting at is that all these mitzvos are highlighting the basic tension of war, which is, on the one hand, life is life and you got to fight sometimes and you have to kill. On the other hand, the reality of needing to fight and kill, we do not want that to undermine the Torah's unique appreciation for Kedushas HaChaim, the sanctity of life. So we emphasize that by putting the mitzvah that most emphasizes how much we care about a single person in the middle of the laws of war, middle of the ethics of war. You're thinking ethics of war, I got to send peace feelers out to the enemy, even if they're a Amalek. We want you to be thinking about Egla Rufa. So I think Chazal are thinking about that as well. You have that reality, the fact that by Egla Arufa, it's being associated, the Pesukim, with war. And now Shaul is going to the Nachal and is going to fight against everything he thought he stood for. So Chazal say that this is a point that just he struggled with, and he couldn't come to grips with it. He couldn't do it. And the Gemara concludes, and it says, "Al tahit tzadik harbe." Don't be too righteous. You should not be done es atzmo. You shouldn't be thinking what you think the Torah should be saying, what you think the halacha should be. Do what you're told. Listen to the Dvar Hashem, even when it is incomprehensible from your perspective. Now, you know, what's so interesting is that if that's true, right, if Shaul actually is struggling with the ethical component of this, so we should think about why he then goes and kills most of Amalek, right? He just leaves Agag alive. Apparently, the idea is that once you go off following your own moral compass, so at the beginning, it may lead to a place where you think is moral, but at the end, you know, leaving Hashem's moral compass and just following your own, you're going to end up in a place where you don't want to be. And as the Gemara points out, where does Shaul end up? He ends up destroying the men and women and children and animals of the city of Nov Irakon. Once he goes following what he thinks is right instead of what Hashem tells him what to do, his moral compass ends up in a place of disaster because he ends up going from pursuing his own morals that very, very easily leads to following his own interests. And that is going to be the failure of Shaul here. How did Yitzhar get him out? How does Yitzhar get him out of thinking of doing what Shmuel says to do? Well, it begins by talking like the Yitzhar Tov, right? This isn't right. You should do what you think is right. And once Shaul does what he thinks is right, coincidentally, what he thinks is right, as we'll see, is going to be a course of action that is very, very, very helpful politically for Shaul the king. Coincidentally, you follow what you think is right, you end up doing stuff that is helpful for you. Let's see how it happens. Now he continues, Pasuk Zion, Shaul goes to war, he smacks Amalek, Mechavila Ba'acha Shur al Pnei Mitzrayim. That Mikra, their map, they think that this covers like the whole Sinai desert. This is a real rigorous war. He wipes out, he smites Amalek. He captures
Agag, the king, alive. Now, normally, I think, you know, like the way this taught in elementary school was Shaul killed every single person from Amalek except for Agag. The king alone survived. That, it's very, very difficult. First of all, later on in Sefer Shmuel, David is going to fight Amalek, and they're going to have thousands of warriors, because the Navi is going to say, like, David wiped out all of them except for 400 people. So it sounds an awful lot like a lot of them still survive. Furthermore, Shmuel is going to talk about Agag's mother later on in the parak, clearly implying that Agag's mother is still alive. So what does it mean that es kol ha'am hechrem lefi charev? We'll define it more sharply in a minute. For now, it means he killed a lot of people, but he keeps Agag alive. But now, you know, one interesting point about that, you know, Agag. So who exactly is Agag? So you think keep this in mind for Purim. This would be a cool Rashbam to quote next year Purim. The Dot Mikra quotes it over here. Bilam, in at least two of his prophecies, references Amalek. Not surprising, because Bilam is talking all about the Messianic era, and there's a lot from the very beginning of the Yad al Kes Ka, the very beginning of the war against Amalek. There are messianic tones. Some of the Rishonim think that the war to fight Amalek only applies nowadays in messianic times. But Bilam says, it's funny, pasuk, Yizal mayim yidal yav v'zaro mayim rabim. So water will flow. Okay, great. Israel's going to be in good shape. V'yarom me'agag malko. Bilam says, Yisrael's king will rise above Agag. V'tinasei malchuso, and his kingdom shall be exalted. What's strange here is that Bilam's prophecies are usually much more general than this, right? Bilam does not specifically name any one person. Original point out, a bunch of Bilam's nevuos point very nicely towards David HaMelech, but it's not like Bilam ever mentioned the word David. So why does he mention the name Agag? You could fill in what this means very easily, right? How was the prophecy fulfilled? Rashi says right there, yeah, Shaul, right? Who's the king who rose above Agag? Shaul rose above Agag. Well, why is Agag named? So the Rashbam has a very interesting comment on this. He says, Agag was just like Paro or Avimelech. Paro, Agag wasn't one individual king of Amalek. Agag was like the royal name for the king of Amalek. So when Bilam says that that the king of Israel will overcome Agag, it will be like Paro. It just means he's gonna defeat the king of Amalek. So then when the Megillah calls Haman ha'Agagi, so it doesn't necessarily mean he's descended from our Agag. It means that Haman is from the royal line of Amalek, right? It means that Haman is from the Agags. It would be like saying that Haman was from the pharaohs. He's associated with Amalek royalty. Now, the tragedy of this pasuk also is that the Aromi Agag Malkova Tinesei Malchuso. You see what should have happened, right? The way that Bilam's prophecy should have been fulfilled was the king will destroy Agag, and then his kingship shall be exalted. But Rashi Yoshbam Parshan points out, how in reality was this prophecy fulfilled since Shaul failed? Well, half of it happened. Shaul was the king who rises above Agag. But since Shaul fails to fulfill the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek, who ends up being the king who is the beneficiary of the second half? Batinase Malchuso. Rashi says, David and Shlomo. Right, one king defeats Agag, and then it's the next king right afterwards, his kingdom shall be exalted, David, who we're going to be introduced to immediately after the failure of Agag. He's coming up in Parak Tzayin. So the tragedy of Shaul was listening to this mitzvah would have been the opportunity for him to be the person whose kingship would be exalted. Instead, his kingship will be destroyed along with Agag, and David is going to come in hot and heavy. Okay. But let's focus on Pasuk Tes for a minute. What exactly was happening? So we know the story. We know that they had mercy on Agag and on the sheep. But but we can tease out. And the question about this always is like, why? Why did Shaul have mercy on Agag? But was it because, you know, he had some sympathy for kings? What was it about Agag per se that Shaul felt this overwhelming Yetzer Hara to keep him alive? Like, Shaul's not stupid. So why does he keep Shaul? Why does he keep Agag of all people alive? So the Navi begins to point to the answer of Pasuk Tes, and it'll become it'll be more drawn out in a couple of Pesukim afterwards. But the Navi says, "Vayachmo Shaul ba'am al Agag, ba'al meitav hatzon b'habakar b'mashlim alakar b'akol hato." So Shaul and the nation, Am often is a pejorative term for the masses. The Eir of Rab is referred to as the Am. The Am, that's not great. That's you know, like the rabble, the masses of the people in a bad way. So they had mercy on Agag and on the best of the sheep. So Pesukim Ches and Tes put two things next to each other. You have the good sheep and the bad sheep. They keep the good sheep and they wipe out the bad sheep. And what is their side by side? What is their Pesuk Ches? They keep Agag alive, and Kol Ha'am, the masses, the rabble, they wipe out. So that's being emphasized. It's the elite which are being kept, and it's the whatever, you know, the all the lousy sheep and all the nameless, mediocre, anonymous people from Amalek who are being killed. Why are we putting them next to each other? Because why are they keeping the finest tzon and the bakar? For personal benefit. I mean, they're going to give some of this as karbanos, but at the end of the day, come on. They're keeping a bunch of this for personal benefit. Marikra thinks that karim even refers to very powerful horses that they could use in warfare. There's spoils over here, and it's for personal benefit. So if that's the case, why are they keeping Agag alive? Keep Agag alive for personal benefit as well, for one of two reasons. One, a king can be a very valuable hostage. You're not going to keep Agag alive because you could ransom him. You can make a ton of money off of ransoming off a king, just like you can make a lot of money off of the Meitav Hatzon v'Habakar. Or you could keep Agag alive because of what happens many times in the Tanakh, which is when one king defeats another king, what you really want to do is take him captive as a demonstration of your own glory. And a king glorifies himself by having all these other kings who are held under him. And that from the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, where we have the king in Aram who is keeping all these other kings, cutting off their thumbs and keeping them under him. We have that at the end of Sefer Malachim, where we have Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, who keep all the captured kings with them in Bava. You want to show you're a real king. A real king has other kings who are captured, who he beat in war, who he keeps beneath him. So Shaul could be capturing Agag for personal benefit, just like the sheep, in a sense of he's a valuable hostage, or maybe more likely, because we'll get money from the tzon, and we'll get glory from Agag. I can show what a great king I am, because look at this living hostage who I have alive. At the end of the day, he's in it for personal benefit. The people, for sure, are in it for personal benefit. They want the money, and Shaul maybe is in it for glory as well. And that's going to be exposed very clearly in the next couple of pesukim, and then this will close. Three more pesukim. Navi says, "Vahid Dvar Hashem al Shmuel Leimor." So now, right, once again, Dvar Hashem. Usually you'd say, you know, Hashem spoke to Shmuel, Hashem appeared to Shmuel. We're using these phrases whenever we can. The word of Hashem came to Shmuel saying, "Nichamti gimlachti yeshu'ul ha'malach, yishav me'acharai." He turns away from me. "Ves Dvarai lo ekim." Again, my word he didn't keep. Fascinatingly, Shmuel is tortured by this. Vayichar l'Shmuel, vayizakar Hashem kol halayla. Shmuel davens all night long to no avail. Unbelievable, because this is the, you know, he was never happy with the monarchy, but Shmuel davens all night long for Shaul. Hashem ignores him. Then pasuk yibbeis. Very, 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 very funny pasuk. Vayashkim Shmuel likra Shaul baboker. Shmuel, who, remember, before had been all-knowing, right? He knew where the donkeys were. He was the ro'eh. But really, the job of a Navi is not to be a ro'eh. The job of a Navi is to communicate what Hashem says. Sometimes Navi doesn't know things. Shmuel doesn't know where Shaul is. So Shmuel gets up early. He wants to meet Shaul. But you got the Shmuel anymore. Let's think about why this is here. It was told to Shmuel saying, Ba Shaul HaKarmela. Shaul came to the Carmel. To point out, this is not like the Har Carmel Carmel. This is probably the place Carmel in Shevet Yehuda, like a south of Hebron. Because he's coming back up from the Sinai. So he goes to this place in Yehuda called Carmel. He set up a monument. Writes the Malbim. What's the monument? The monument is a monument to the glory of his victory. And now he's turning and he's going to Gilgal. We know Gilgal. That's near the Jordan River. That's where we've been twice already with Shaul. And he's going to go there to offer karbanos. He's going there to offer karbanos. So, like, why does the Navi have to tell us this? Why do we have to know Shaul's itinerary on the way back from the Sinai? Who cares? Just, you know, we should just know he went down to meet him in Gilgal. Why do we have to know everything before this? Also, if we think for a second, we have to think about the chronology. Shaul has a big army. And we know they have lots of captives because they have lots of sheep. Stuff doesn't move very quickly. How long does it take to get from the Sinai to Midbar Yehuda and then to Gilgal? I don't know for sure because I don't know like the average miles per day with a lot of sheep. A few days. It takes a few days. So when did Hashem give the Nevuah to Shmuel? It was not immediately after the battle because Shmuel wakes up the next morning and he's told, Shaul has come back with his army. They've already set up the monument at Carmel, and now he's going down to Gilgal. That means that Hashem did not actually give the Nevuah to Shmuel, telling him that he's firing Shaul as king, until after the battle, after taking all the captives, and after Shaul came back to Eretz Yisrael and set up a monument. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was when Shaul set up a yad to his own victory before offering karbanos that Hashem finally comes to Shmuel and tells him, it's official, let me tell you, you've been waiting for information from the battle, let me tell you what happened, Shaul didn't listen to me. Why? Why is that so important? Why does the Navi have to tell us this? Presumably because this just exposes the depths of Shaul's failure. What began as a question of ethics, and using that as a wedge to get him out of following the divine command, incredibly has led to Shaul fighting a war that is perfectly calibrated to help his political position. He's got wealth, he's got spoils, he has a prestigious captive. He now then comes back, and after fighting a war, the goal of which was to erase the memory of Amalek, I don't want to remember any of them, destroy everything, Yeridachas, there should be nothing left. Shaul builds a monument memorializing his victory. Why does he do it? It's in Carmel, it's in the land of Yehuda. If you're trying to keep Yehuda under your control, best way to do it is to say, hey, look at this, you know, Mount Rushmore statue. Remember the time that I saved you from Amalek? Look at that statue of the time that I fought this great victory for you. Very, very helpful for him from a political perspective. But what has Shaul done? He has replaced listening to Devar Hashem with listening to himself and fighting the battle originally on his own moral terms and then ultimately just for his own goal and not for the goal of Hashem. And it is because of that, right? Once we think of Shaul fighting, you know, from a political perspective, not just from a he was commanded perspective, so this then opens up with this idea, we'll close the point that Rav Lechenzin Zatzal would make all the time when talking about Amalek. And the truth is, it's already here in the Chafetz Chaim. The two of them make the exact same point. Chafetz Chaim has a good, he has like a clever question in the pasuk. In a couple of psukim, the Navi is going to say that Shmuel did evil. The Navi is going to say, Vata'as hara b'nei Hashem. And Shmuel is going to blast Shaul, you did evil. So Chafetz Chaim asks, the problem with Shaul wasn't what he did, right? It's what he didn't do. It's that he failed to wipe out all of Amalek. So Chabad Chaim asks, why is Shmuel criticizing Shaul for what he did? So the answer that he gives, or Lochatzin said the exact same thing, was that once Shaul fights the war against Amalek, not because he was commanded to do so, but because he sees the political, personal advantages of it, we then have to go back and reevaluate everything he did. All the men, women, and children that he had killed in the battle. If he had done that because of loyalty to what Hashem had told him, right? This is Amalek, this is a unique threat. I don't fully understand it. That's what Shmuel told me to do, so I'll set aside my own qualms and listen to the Dvar Hashem. That would have been one thing. But once he leaves that avenue, then we have to go back and say, Shaul, why were you wiping out men, women, and children? Torah says, when you normally fight a war, the non-combatants must be left alive. So the Chafetz Chaim says, that's the Tas Hara. Shaul now is being castigated, not only for those who he didn't kill, he's being castigated for letting Agag survive, but now we also have to go back and castigate him for those that he did kill, because those who he did kill was no longer in the pursuit of a melchamet mitzvah. It was in the pursuit of just a cruel policy that was being done for his own gain. That's the point that they made. So it ends, right? He begins with not listening to Kol Hashem, listening to his own voice. Once he wants his own benefit, then we take a step back and say, oh my gosh, look at what you did from a moral perspective. The Nitziv we talked last week about the Nitziv's writings about Amalek and Hashkacha. The Nitziv in Parshas Balak and Pinchas, when he talks about Pinchas, why is it that after Pinchas kills Zimri and Cusbi, he's given the covenant of peace, right? Brisi Shalom. So Nitziv writes, because the normal consequence of taking a spear and ramming it into two people and killing them in cold blood is that it transforms your essence. You become a murderer. It's corrupting. So Nitziv says, that was the bracha that was given to Pinchas. Since he was doing what he was doing in the pursuit of what Hashem needed him to do, so Hashem says, miraculously, you will remain as innocent as you had been before. Normally a Kohen who murders can't serve the Beis HaMikdash, can't do Berachas Kohanim, Pinchas, you're being promoted to the Kohuna. The normal consequences of your actions are not going to affect you. Shaul, had he done the same thing, right? Had he gone to Amalek like Pinchas and said, I'm doing what I have to because that's what Hashem said, he would have been ethically insulated and would have emerged unscathed. Since he doesn't, since he goes in fighting the battle on his terms, he's permanently corrupted by what happens in this war against Amalek. We'll begin already to see that next week at the end of this parak. We'll begin to see how that is already corrupting Shaul, and it's going to proceed more and more clearly in the coming prakim until most dramatically, as Chazal point out, he's going to wipe out Nov, the city of the Kohanim, in exactly the way that Hashem had told him to wipe out the city, the people of Amalek. So when we come back next week, we'll look at Shmuel's reaction and the follow-through. But for now,